Welcome to the Regen Brands Podcast. This is a place for consumers, operators, and investors to learn about the consumer brands supporting regenerative agriculture and how they're changing the world. This is your host, Kyle, joined with my co-host, Dave C. Let's dive in. On this episode, we have Abby Ann Fala, who is the co-founder of CatSpring Yaupon. CatSpring Yaupon is supporting regenerative agriculture with its loose leaf and bagged Yaupon teas and also its new Vibe Yaupon crystals. You might be saying, what is Yaupon? It is the one and only naturally caffeinated plant that is native to North America. In this episode, we learn all about Yaupon and Abby Ann's work building both a brand and a completely new consumer category at the same time. We loved having Abby Ann join us, and we're excited to share this episode with you all. Let's dive in. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Regen Brands Podcast. We are live here, not actually live, Kyle's going to correct me, but we're live with Abby Ann from CatSpring Yaupon. Super excited to dive into her business today. So welcome, Abby Ann.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're super excited. You know, we connected, I think it was 3-4 months ago at this point, and I had never heard of Yaupon. I didn't know anything about it, and it was one of the coolest, most interesting stories, both from like a plant perspective and the historical perspective. I'm not going to try to recap it because you're going to do a much better job than I am today, but we're really excited to have you on and to teach all of us about this unique plant.
Yes. Thanks. Yeah, looking forward to sharing.
Cool. Well, before we get too far into the origin story, tell us, you know, for those who are completely unfamiliar with the brand, you know, what do you make? You know, how many products do you have? How many SKUs, flavors, things like that? And where can people purchase your product today?
Sure. So we are 100% Yaupon. That is all we do. We like to say it's Texan for tea, but simply it's the only caffeinated plant native to North America. So we sell it under our own brand, CatSpring Yaupon, in tea bags and loose leaf. And those are available online, Amazon, Whole Foods in the Southwest, Central Market, that sort of thing. And then we also, a lot of our business is as bulk and ingredient sales. So we sell to kombucha brewers, like Greenbelt Kombucha here in Texas, Yes Folk up in New York, and smaller brewers all over the U.S. And then we also sell to tea companies. So like Harney & Sons does a bottled Yaupon for Sweet Green. And then we also are a basis for some energy drinks like Rambler sparkling water here in Texas. And then we also sell to restaurants, hotels, and spas. So I guess like Local Foods is actually going to put Yaupon on their spring menu. So
That's
where you can find us.
That was a lot more places than I had anticipated. That's a lot. Is it safe to say you've got like a monopoly on Yaupon right now? Are you selling just to everybody?
We're the largest producers of it in the world, which, I mean, considering the size of the market in and of itself, take that statement with a grain of salt. But we've been doing it for 10 years. And so we've been in kind of an interesting position of building both a brand and a product category. So we've kind of chosen to have some more fun collaborations and partnerships and supply to other people as we build the brand. So,
yeah. Love that. Not too indifferent from some of the other folks we've interviewed about kind of building the brand and the category at the same time. Definitely a takeaway there is that Texas takes care of its own. I mean, all this Texas connection. So I always love that about the great state of Texas. You mentioned 10 years ago. I want you to take us back there and kind of give us the origin story. We also want to give you a shout out for coming on the show 9 months pregnant, expecting your second child. So we got to give you love there, and we appreciate
Thank
that.
You.
Yep. Appreciate and congratulations.
Thanks.
But take us back 10 years ago, I'm guessing before both children, and where this thing all start from.
Yeah. So, it was actually, I don't know if y'all would remember, but, 2011 was the driest year in Texas recorded history. I think now they're saying we lost 200 million trees statewide.
200 million?
Yes.
Wow.
Damn. Because I mean, it takes a few years to really see how many are going to die off.
Everything's bigger in Texas, even the drought.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, even the droughts, exactly, right? And so where we were, in Cat Spring, everything was looking like wilted spinach. Everyone's selling off their cattle. We're losing 100-year-old oak trees. And, the only thing that wasn't dying was yaupon. And we've always known the plant because it would be considered a weed if it wasn't native, right? It's a very tenacious grower. Leave an abandoned building, and yaupon will grow through the walls in a matter of years. It takes over your fence lines. Yeah, it really grows unchecked. And so we've always known the plant, but had no idea that it was anything other than a nuisance until this drought. And so started to do some research. You know, I wish I could say we had the foresight to be like, oh, something special with this plant. But really, it was like in the same vein of like, there has to be something, you know, about like, why don't fire ants die? why is this plant not dying? And through that, just started to see some research that was coming out of Texas A&M and the University of Florida that were, you know, this is the only domestic source of caffeine that's native to North America. Antioxidants comparable to blueberries. It's a natural anti-inflammatory. It has all these incredible benefits. It's a natural cleanser. And then at the same time, realizing that virtually every tribe along the Gulf Coast and up into the Outer Banks actually had a tradition with it. And so, so the first recorded history, like the first recorded observed yaupon was actually in 1542 with Cabeza de Vaca when he came through Texas. And
so, incredible.
Yeah. And so it was ubiquitous. It was consumed. It was traded. They're even finding traces of it in ceremonial pottery all the way up to like Cahokia and St. Louis and over to Arizona and Colorado. And they're actually using the caffeine in these ceremonial pottery to recreate the trade routes of a couple hundred years ago. And so yaupon was the drink of North America. With the Spanish, they loved it. They actually, when they came into Florida and Texas, they took it back to Europe. And then we all remember the Boston Tea Party. So the English had a different relationship with tea and didn't want anything to disrupt the power of that tea trade. And so yauponer became a derogatory term, which meant you were too poor to afford imported tea. And
History's crazy.
It's kind of a brilliant scheme on the English part. Super messed up, but effective.
Yeah. And and some historians think that the Scottish botanist who named it was actually employed by Ceylon tea traders at the time, because the scientific name is Ilex vomitoria, even though there's no emetic properties or anything. So it's kind of crazy. And then obviously with the forced relocation and mass eradication of a lot of the indigenous peoples that were drinking it, yaupon really has been largely forgotten. There are pockets of slaves that grew it. And then during the Civil War, the South drank it. And then during World War II, actually, the USDA tried to promote it as a viable caffeine alternative. But other than that, it's really just been forgotten.
Wow.
It's so crazy.
So many questions.
This is the second time I've heard it, and it's still blowing my mind.
Yeah.
You know, and what strikes me is the most interesting, I don't know, like ironic part of this is like how much caffeine is consumed in North America, what percentage of that is imported, whereas we've had this indigenous caffeinated plant, I mean, since the first settlers arrived here, and it's just completely like not even on people's radar. Like if you were to guess today, how many people do you think like even have yaupon on the radar and know what that is? Sub 5%, sub 1% of the population in North America?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a tiny, tiny amount. I mean, we're seeing more and more traction, which is exciting. Especially compared to when we first started out 10 years ago. And people only know it from like, oh, yeah, I bulldozed and burned that. So we've definitely, that percentage is moving, but it's still tiny. And I think what's super fascinating is the caffeine in Yaupon is actually, it's pretty mild. So it's like maybe 25 milligrams, but it is with like the theobromine and theacrine, it's a longer release. So some of our like advisor, or like food scientist advisors think it's because it's a delayed release in our system. And so it's more of like mental clarity, and more of a sustained. And so it's like, that's actually what more people want than the spike of the imported or synthetic caffeines. And so it's something that's right here that is actually even better. You know, it's a, no wonder the Cherokees called it their beloved tree. Right. And we're just now figuring that out.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what does the plant actually look like? I looked on around the website and you might have had pictures, but I just didn't see them. But what does it look like when it's grown?
Yeah, sure. So it is, if you're physically here, I would just point outside and show you, because everyone in Texas uses it for their landscape as well, just because it is such a tenacious plant. But yeah, so it's almost like a shrub that left unattended can grow. It's an understory tree. So it can grow 20, 30 feet high, and just kind of really depends on where you are and how it, like what it's been given free rein on. You know, where we harvest, some of the Yaupon is just, you can't even walk through it. Like deer can't even walk through it. It's just so dense.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So talk us through, we're going to kind of go, like, we used to have like a regular set of questions, but because this is such a unique plant, like a lot of those questions are not going to apply here. So, you know, when I think about regenerative agriculture and people, you know, putting seeds in the ground and having rows of crops and harvesting them, like that seems to be like a relatively similar process across a variety of different, you know, plants. It doesn't seem to be the case here. So what is like the actual like farmland look like? How do you harvest it? You walk us through that process.
Yeah, sure. So we actually are sustainably wild harvesting it. And which, you know, so we're foraging, and which obviously means something a little different in Texas than it does in most other parts of the U.S. because it's all pot. Like, we don't believe in public lands in Texas, so it's all privately owned. And so we work with landowners, in, so we have about 1100 acres that are certified wild growth, certified regenerative, organic, non-GMO and kosher, that really is just wild. And,
and just, Yaupon, just to clarify, when you say wild, that's like you don't plant anything, you don't water anything. This is just growing and you're just harvesting. Incredible.
Yes. It's amazing. And and it's interesting too, because what we think might be the most actual sustainable thing would be to, as we harvest, to be reintroducing native grasses as we go. And that's something that we're trying to work with the USDA National Conservation Resource Services to do a pilot program for. But the reason the Yaupon grows so tenaciously is because of all of the native grasses that were replaced for hay and cattle. If we're looking at like a coastal grass, we're looking at like 3 to 12 inch root systems. And the native grasses, as we know, have anywhere from 3 feet to 15 feet. Right. And so, because Yaupon spreads as a rhizome, it just grows totally unchecked, which is why.
Well, clarify, what does that statement mean? Grows as a rhizome.
Wow.
So when it's stressed or when it wants to grow, it just spreads its roots and then sends shoots up from that. And so often the trees that we're harvesting are pretty tightly related. They're all coming from the same root systems. And so what Yaupon as an understory tree will do also is that it'll put its roots and rhizomes through oak trees or through other protected places. So even if you're cutting it down, you can't, it'll just come right back. And in fact, when it gets stressed, it shoots its rhizomes further and then will send up shoots to for like what looked like little trees.
Wow. So you could like cut it down and then like come back a month later and there could be more of it than when you cut it down because of the way it like spreads and grows.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Incredible.
So this 1100 acres, did that happen by accident? Are you paying someone to like keep it in a certain profile? Like you have all the certifications that you mentioned, like what, how does that, how do you know where to begin there?
In some ways we're actually really doing these landowners a favor. We're helping them with something a little bit more of a sustainable alternative in how to manage some of this yaupon growth, trying to keep the fence lines cleared, the trails access, to promote, you know, ecodiversity so that the deer and the animals can get through. But then also, you know, most of the research that's been done by like ag extension agencies is more how to eradicate yaupon, than even like what its benefits are or how to grow it, you know? That's what most of the studies, that's what most of the money behind yaupon has been, is like how to best spray and kill it.
Will animals eat it?
They will. They don't love it because of the caffeine. So caffeine is usually a natural defense. And so the deer and the cattle and if there's nothing else, they'll eat it. But they prefer other things. And then the berries, birds will eat the berries and things like that. But yeah.
They're smarter than us. We're trying to OD on caffeine and they're
eat it. Right.
So as you're explaining this, the way I'm now thinking about harvest is like your team shows up in trucks on people's private land and just start picking leaves off of these like shrub trees.
Yeah,
I don't know how to oversimplify or like diminish what is actually happening. I'm just trying to put a visual because like
it's not similar.
Conventional agriculture.
Yeah, and I think if you visualize like the same as like a tea harvest, right? Often people are out physically, whether it's like the baskets on their back or however they're doing it mechanically. It's all about the leaves, and so for us, the harvest looks a little different sometimes depending on what works best for the land and access and all that sort of thing, just because we're not in a cultivated setting. But in essence, that's what we're doing, just getting the leaves.
Incredible.
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, I think we'll
literally,
go
it's wild.
Yeah,
yeah.
Literally it is wild.
Yeah,
we can talk more about kind of growing practices, supply chain. I want to come back there in a second, but I also want to pick up the origin story of, okay, now we understand the history, know a little bit about the plant. I can't even imagine trying to commercialize this thing, right? Like you said, creating a category while you're creating the brand, you're trying to do a lot of wholesale stuff to kind of further commercialize. Like, where the hell did that start? And like, how, what's the arc been like to get, you know, to this point?
Sure. So, our first commercial harvest was in 2013. So first kind of started paying attention to it in 2011 and then just did some playing around with different preparation methods.
Do you remember the first cup you ever drank?
Yes.
What was that experience like?
Honestly, it was kind of a like, well, we haven't seen anywhere that it's poisonous. even though like actually the USDA website did say it was poisonous. I've had to work with them to get that changed. But
the good old USDA.
I'm like, no, I like Spalmatoria. There's no medic properties. So that was kind of our first experience. And two, like we were like, wait, if this history is true and it had this tradition, like it must taste terrible, right? Like that's the only reason we could think of that nobody had it commercially available, and it hasn't been for decades. And so we just were like, it must taste terrible. Let's try it. But it actually tasted all right, and enough that we kept on like trying different tea and yerba mate and just kind of different preparation methods to see what we could land on. Burned a lot of leaves.
I believe that. I also derailed Anthony's question like I typically do. How did the commercialization process work?
So So we really kind of started by just like, hey, let's put a landing page and see if people are looking for it and potentially solicit some free feedback. And so we'd send off preparation methods that we were trying. And I started to do some farmers markets here in Austin. And from that, actually had a couple chefs come forward that were, you know, aware of the fact that like if they wanted a farm to table restaurant, there's a big hole when it comes to the coffee and tea portion of their menu. And so some of our first customers were actually Dai Dway here in Austin and Odd Duck. And we became their iced tea and still are to this day, which is pretty crazy. And
I love Texas, man. Oh, Texas is the best. God, I love it.
Yeah. And so, and that was, so and to get their feedback and their affirmation was huge, right? So it's like, okay, these James Beard nominated chefs think that our Yopan is worthy of putting on their menu, then maybe we've got something here. And so, yeah, just started small and then, started approaching tea companies and, trying to get feedback and yeah, been kind of chipping away at that for a decade now, which is crazy to think. I think if I had known how much of an uphill battle we had, I don't know that I would have started out. In my mind, I was like, 2 years, everyone in the world will know.
Said every CPG founder ever. I'm super curious about that, right? Because like on the food service side, chefs are very creative. They're usually more open-minded. They're you know, they're going to trial things faster and quicker than retail. So like, when you're sitting there with Whole Foods or whoever, like how the hell do you explain them what this is and how do you like vouch that you should get shelf space next to the, you know, the green tea that's already like on the shelf?
Yeah, I think with Whole Foods, it's been a very interesting and I'm grateful for the journey we've had with them because it's been, I know the experience we've had has been kind of the opposite of what most people have. So because some of our customers were on Whole Foods shelves to start, so like Greenbelt Kombucha, Rambler with their sparkling water. And then, you know, since we started, there've been an addition of several other Yopan companies, which is awesome. It's on industry if you're the only brand. And so I actually had to work with Whole Foods legal team a couple years back because of the FDA grass status of Yopan. And so that was something that I had navigating with the FDA for a few years. And so, which was funny because they're like, oh, we haven't added anything to the list since the 70s. Do you have any historical evidence? And I was like, oh, just you wait. Like, here.
Starting. Let me get my citations out real quick. MLA format for you.
Pretty much. Starting in 1540s and then all the way up to the USDA Board of Chemistry, which was the precursor to the FDA. Wow. They're the ones that actually tried to promote it as an industry and were selling it at state fairs. And so I was like, here's your former predecessors who were selling it. And so, yeah, so we finally got some documentation from them. But so I'd worked with Whole Foods to kind of shore up the legal side of it. And then I think, you know, what they have done, and I really, you know, respect the way that they're trying to help suppliers clean up their sourcing and everything from coffee to tea. And I think they realize that tea in and of itself is a really hard industry to help clean up. And so what they wanted to do was to promote sustainable alternatives or sustainable ingredients within the tea category. And that's where we fell. And fortunately, I live in Austin and had some relationships there. And so they asked if we would come on the shelf. And then they've named Yopan as the top food trend for 2023, which is really exciting.
Yeah, so. Let's go.
Congrats. Huge win.
Yeah, congrats on these wins after a decade long battle. Those are important to celebrate, right?
They feel nice for sure. A little bit more of a groundswell than a pushing a boulder up a mountain for sure.
Right. Yeah. You know, one of the things you mentioned tea a couple times in that and how tea is difficult to clean up. Expand a little bit about why it's hard to clean up and then like from a consumer perspective. If they were to choose Yopan versus tea, like what sort of environmental impact each of those decisions make and why somebody would want to trade up to Yopan?
We sure. want a hard sell, Abianne. Put the Texas humility aside, and I want to hear you hard sell the Yopon. All right.
There's a difference between like a soft TO and a pressure TO, just for the record.
And I will do it for you at the end if you need me to.
That sounds great. So, I mean, sweeping statements. Obviously, there are some really great single origin tea farms that are taking care of their people and doing great agriculture. Unfortunately, they're very much the exception. So tea as an industry is, it's obviously an old industry, right? And so the way that the sourcing works, you're often, the distributor is purchasing on a market from a different country, and they're 3 to 4 steps removed in purchasing from who's actually harvesting it. So then you lose so much transparency in that. And then also it's often coming from countries where agriculture is a really hard industry to regulate. And so even the organic certification has massive exposure to drift, right? So, you know, we've seen reports where anywhere from even 30 to 50% of tea that is organic still has traces amounts of herbicides and pesticides.
And when you say drift, you're talking because neighbor farms will be spraying and that drift of the spray will end up on the quote, USDA organic certified lands.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not even necessarily like a malicious trying to dupe the organic inspection. It's just a function of the fact of developing nations. And that's not even touching on the human treatment of these harvesters and workers. Mm-hmm. And so because so much of the purchasing in this industry is so far removed from the growing, it's different than coffee in that sense, or more like coffee used to be 15, 20 years ago, or still is on the commodity side. And then the other thing is tea is never washed when it's being processed. So the first time those leaves touch water is when you steep it. And so if it has been sprayed with anything directly or indirectly, you're drinking it because that's the first time it's ever rinsed.
And it's like more bioavailable. Like you're basically like supercharging it to like be worse for you in that setting too.
Right. You're heating it and putting it in water and drinking it. Right. And so
pesticides.
Yeah. Yum. That's wild. So it's even more important as a food product that it is clean. And so, you know, there's that perspective. And then there's the fact that everything that is coming on a ship or on a plane to get to the US, right? Like, obviously, there's some tea growers in Hawaii and I think one or two farms, but, you know, most of the tea they grow is sold in their gift shop. It's not anything that's moving the needle on production. And so from a sustainability perspective, everything is imported. And then also the fact that, you know, a lot of that cultivation requires water. And because we're wild harvesting and we don't use water in any of our processing, like the cup that you brew, like is literally one for one of water that's been added.
Wow.
And so that's it's huge. Really, yeah, it's really that's low huge. Water usage. It's, the carbon footprint is so small. And the fact that, you know, we're not fighting Mother Nature for a crop that shouldn't be here. In fact, it's this crop that is fighting everyone else to be here. So, you know, those factors alone are huge in the sustainability aspect and alternative for Yopon over imported tea or coffee. So,
yeah.
That's insane. So I'm going to try to like recap that in like bullet points, essentially.
Let's go.
So
let's go.
It's like the human aspect for like the treatment of workers in these different countries where they're developing nations and for reasons that we can't control, it's just harder to enforce good labor practices. Two, there's like the pesticide, herbicide drift issue, which is, you know, to no fault of any tea, you know, brand, they're trying to get organic and that's just hard to do because of where these crops are grown. Three, there's the water issue, which I mean, as we all know, the Colorado River is like literally drying up as we speak. So not using water in Texas and having a plant that's like super, you know, requires literally no irrigation is incredible. I'm sure I'm missing one. Anthony, help me out here.
I think the carbon footprint from a logistics standpoint, right? So look, to round this all up, if you're going to buy coffee or tea to get caffeinated, buy organic and regenerative coffees and teas, right? From great brands that are out there doing great work. We salute them. They're amazing. But like, why I was so fired to speak with y'all is this is the native caffeinated plant. Like, so when we talk beyond just soil health principles and regenerative ag principles, like if we talk about deeper regeneration of like connection to place and like all those reasons we just mentioned, like this is what we should actually be drinking. Like this is the past teaching us like, hey, idiots, like slap in the face, like this, look at this, like this is really the actual solution. So it's powerful stuff.
Well, and I feel like that isn't that just the extension of the regenerative conversation that we're having, right? Like, I'm a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation, and so I'm a part of the Intertribal Agricultural Council. And so, and so much of that is it's like, and that's not a tradition I grew up with. It's what I'm learning. But at the same time, it's like, they're like, you mean regenerative organic? You mean how we've always been producing? Like,
how say it again for the people in the back. Say it again for the people in the back.
You mean how we did this entire country before y'all got here? And so it's I think it is tied to that, right? Like, why would we produce Yopan in any other way when it is so deeply tied to so many different indigenous tribes, you know, in this tradition? And then the same way that like, I know at least for the Chickasaws, like we defined being a warrior, as being a steward of the land. Like that was just how the approach was to everything, our interaction with, the land, with other tribes, with people. And that's something that is still carried forward today, even though, you know, Yopan doesn't grow as well in Oklahoma. So the tradition has been really lost, from back when we were in Mississippi. But at the same time, like, yeah, it's, I feel like it's a big parallel to that bigger conversation of like, yeah, regenerative organic, it's nothing new. It's what you made all of the indigenous people stop doing, a couple hundred years ago. So yeah.
And those caffeinated crops have such a horrible history of like, you know, aggressive colonization from a geopolitical standpoint for the Western world to basically profit off of these marginalized, you know, other countries. So there's so much to unpack there. And I love that you tied that all in, and it's beautifully said. So thank you.
Thank you.
It's also, I mean, when you think about just the difference between like when you have your cup of Yopan or your cup of tea, and to think about the journey of that plant, you know, somebody walking onto somebody's land and picking some leaves. Again, I'm probably way oversimplifying that because I've obviously never done it.
Versus like, but yes.
Yeah, right. Probably like attacking you. It sounds like this like bush really scrub. The Yopan tree just wants to like survive no matter what. So
yeah,
probably makes it a little bit harder than that. But compare that to something that has been shipped and sold from, you know, multiple different hands. And like you mentioned, Anthony, like the oppressed peoples of, you know, smaller nations. It's just insane to think about. And yeah, if I don't drink caffeine, I really want to drink caffeine just to drink this product. but yeah, to be able to harvest this in our backyard in a way that is like beneficial and I almost said sustainable, regenerative, is just extraordinary.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the history of Yopan, which is extraordinarily interesting, just like a fascinating topic. And I think we probably just barely scratched the surface. I'm sure you have a ton of other interesting stories.
I'll limit my nerding out for y'all though.
I mean, honestly, if we had more time, citations and everything, just, like, dive in. It's just such a cool story. We need like a Netflix documentary on the history of Yopan. Yeah. So if Netflix is listening, like, let's make that happen. So we talked about the history of the plant. We talked about your story and your journey with Yopan and that 10-year arc to where we are today, and the current success that you have with Whole Foods and the numerous other partners and channels. What does the future outlook look like for Cat Spring and for Yopan?
I think, you know, we've got a couple different directions that we can look, right? So this is the perk and the downside of building a brand, a product category, and building an agricultural manufacturing company.
Just a few things.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm like, what was
this? There's a lot going on. also, creating about to have a child.
Yeah. Also, any
things
day
on my plate.
So I think you know, if we're looking back towards the sourcing, I think we've got hypotheses that we want to try out, that we're just trying to figure out the best way to experiment and then potentially scale. So everything from the reintroduction of the native grasses and the importance of those root systems, you know, being upriver from Houston, we see the, you know, the destruction that having massive runoff and lack of water table replenishment has, from an agricultural perspective. And then, you know, along those lines too, is like, well, how do we, you know, my hope is that Yopon becomes a hugely successful industry. And so if that's the case, then there's going to be a huge scale of demand. And how do we help establish the practices that will prevent us from, you know, making some of the mistakes that perhaps some of the yerba mate producers had over the years. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons I helped start the American Yopon Association, with a couple of the other producers, that we can share a little bit of our practices, and also just, you know, help people as they start out, so that we can kind of bring them up a level too. Cause it's, you know, if somebody is producing a subpar product and then somebody experiences Yopon for the first time in a way that isn't great, then they don't know to differentiate and they may never try another one. And so that's part of like helping to help the brand, the industry kind of level up as we go. Along those lines too, of like trying to help share the research, right? Because like I mentioned before, most of the research around Yopon has been done on how to eradicate it. And there's so much, that needs to be done to substantiate a lot of the health claims. And I think we really only scratched the surface just to even see the benefits of this. You know, it's really rich in saponins, which is a natural cleanser, and it's really rich in anti-inflammatory properties, which is shown to be chemo preventative in a petri dish in colon cancer. Obviously, we put that nowhere because you don't touch the C word in marketing. But, you know, at the same time, here's this incredible benefit that is that we need to substantiate into be able these other things that we want to be able to develop. And so there's the research side of it. And then for me, a lot of the fun part is just a lot of the partnerships that are growing and scaling with, you know, I mentioned Rambler and their energy drinks in Greenbelt with their kombucha and different restaurants and food distributors. You know, we love working with them. And it's also fun too. Like we just do Yopon. Back in the day, we used to try to do blends and that sort of thing and realize like, now we'd rather work with people who are really good at that. And that's all they do.
Love that.
And we'll supply the Yopon and we, you know, we have three different preparation methods. So we have three flavors, but it's all Yopon. So it's like a green, a medium roast and a dark roast. And so it's just employing different traditional tea methods to bring out the flavor profiles. And so, that's where we stop. And, yes, we love the collaboration piece of it. And then I think on the product side, we're figuring out how do we reach more people, right? Like how do we put Yopon in more and more people's hands? And also knowing that like tea in and of itself, like, yes, it's a huge industry and market, but at the same time, like not everyone even owns a kettle and makes their own tea bags and makes their own tea. And so how do we get in front of more people? And we've soft launched an instant product called Vibe by Cat Spring Yopon.
I saw that. I want to ask you about that. They look sick.
So it's this really, really clean technology. It's literally just a dehydrated concentrate. And so it's 100% Yopon. It's instantly soluble in hot or cold water. And like one vial is about 10 servings. So that's something that we've soft launched to get more and more feedback for people. But yeah, it's an easy way to get iced tea or iced Yopon, and get those health benefits, throughout the day without having to physically steep a tea bag, or loose leaf. So
my 90s brain immediately goes back to like mayo, like those like droplets that you put in water for like flavoring. So it's essentially, it's that concept, but something that's actually like beneficial for you. And crystals. It's like tea on the go in whatever sort of container or water bottle you have with you.
Liquid. Yeah, it's a crystals and not a liquid. Exactly. Okay. And historically, a lot of the like even if you're looking at like a Crystal Light or some of the instant coffees, they were made by like you would spray the concentrate on a starch or on something else, and that's what was soluble. Mm. But this is, there's nothing added. It is literally just a dehydrated concentrate. And so it's pretty exciting. It's technology that's only really developed in the last few years. And so,
Wow.
I love that. Three things are coming to mind for me. One, I'm going to buy some of that product as soon as we get off, because like for my afternoon pick me up, I don't want a full 100, 150 milligrams of caffeine, but like that 25 to 50 that Yopon has that is more slower releasing, like would be perfect. So love that product innovation. One, two, I love your approach around collaboration and kind of trying to use people that already have bigger existing audiences or markets that have built up trust, because I'm from the Midwest and I think of like elderberries. Elderberries are like such a cool plant that like has all these great health benefits and has all these great ecological benefits. And like it hasn't scaled at all. And why is that? I don't know. I'm not an elderberry expert, so I'm not going to pretend to know. But my assumption is one of the problems is we haven't plugged into some of those larger scaled people and leverage that scale to like bring that the beauty and the efficacy of that product to the masses. And I love that you're trying to do that with Yopon. From a nerdy ecological, you know, region ag question, you talk about the native grasses. Is the vision for that, that they're like planted with the Yopon plants and they're right next to them, and it's just better for like the overall land ecosystem to build back native grasses? It's just that simple? Or is it, we're going to replace the Yopon plants that are old? Or like, just talk to me a little bit more about the actual, usage you're talking about with the native grasses.
Yeah. So, I mean, partly this is what we really need to experiment to see. I think it's going to be a mixture of that, right? Yopon tends to shade out everything else. So it can't be too closely tied. But at the same time, if we're making kind of like our hypothesis would be like swaths or large trails running through. And so then that allows more of the access, the water, and then even actually makes it easier for us to harvest as well. So it would be something that would be a kind of a hybrid of the two of those. So not wiping out necessarily huge acreage of the Yopon, but rather kind of figuring out what that middle ground would be that they can play well together.
Picturing like silvopasture.
I'm chuckling a little bit here because
that like I'm picturing like silvopasture, like Yopon and native grasses, like silvopasture. Maybe not that Victorian of like rows of trees, but like something similar to that. That's really the goal, right? Okay, cool.
What blows my mind about this conversation is that most people are looking to grow more of a particular plant, and it feels like you're trying to rein in the Yopon and like almost like create a native grasses fence, if you will, around the Yopon, like you said, to make it a little bit easier to harvest. And what I like about that is, you know, I think you mentioned this earlier, that the native grasses were eradicated to grow hay and alfalfa or something along those lines. And it sounds like the Yopon can fight and win that battle every time. And that, what I'm assuming happens with the native grasses is that maybe they can fight back a little bit harder and actually, like, you know, that's the biodiverse crop or grass or whatever that's supposed to be there. And they probably interact better together in the soil and have a better nutrient exchange sort of a thing.
And it's interesting because this is not where, so there's some other Yopon producers, like I mentioned, and they are, you know, everywhere from along the Gulf Coast, Georgia and Florida. And Yopon doesn't grow like this there. It grows, you know, they're having to, they've already had to start cultivating the plant because it doesn't grow anywhere near as densely. And our thinking is that a lot of it has to do with the sandy loam, like the sand and clay mix that we have here. Yopon doesn't thrive in the marshy, wetter soil. It likes to be coastal, but it hasn't taken over like it has in our area. And I mean, you can even just look, it's like almost this like perfect map of these fingers of like this kind of sandy clay staggering. I mean, we can walk a mile and switch between the two where we are in Catspring several times. And so it's just this interesting mix is what we think has really played a huge part of that. But likely because of the eradication of those native grasses. And then also there was more prescribed burning when, where we were was in like Karankawa region. And so they would actually do more prescribed burnings, and that sort of thing. But yeah, where Cat Spring is really, really deep German and Czech ties. So, you know, some of the landowners that we work with, they're, and actually the, our manufacturing facility is in an old 1880s blacksmith shop that we've retrofitted.
Cool.
And he,
super
he came over from Germany in the 1850s. And so, yeah, so it's, they were bringing in like the potatoes and, very different agriculture. And then obviously, now it's a lot more cattle, but yeah, some of these families, can tie back to like the original Austin 300 families that came, with Stephen F. Austin. So it's a really kind of traditional area, but yeah, the agriculture has changed a lot in the last 100-200 years. So that's where we are.
Yeah. I have a question. You just talk about retrofitting an old blacksmith shop. Let's shift from agronomy to economy, right? And
man,
come on,
the guy, I like it.
Yeah, man.
You know how it is.
What are you, a podcast host? That was insane.
Don't make me blush while I'm trying to deliver my question. The question is really around financing and how have you funded the organization? Because two of our big takeaways from all these conversations, especially with the emerging brands, is we need a different kind of funder and we probably need new funding mechanisms. So very curious how the fundraising and financing piece has been for y'all through all this work that you've done.
Yeah, sure. So to date, we actually haven't raised any funding. And it's been entirely through USDA grants is how I've
love that.
This. Yeah.
Tell us more there. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So non-dilutive
capital, baby. That's the name of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, we've gotten close to $1 million over the last 10 years in USDA.
Wow.
Very, like between the USDA and the Texas Department of Agriculture, kind of piecemealing all of that together and awards as well. So I tend to apply for anything. So we've won like Eileen Fisher, Women Entrepreneur, a WeWork Creator Award. Trying to think, there've been others, but and then the USDA Value Added Producer Grant we've gotten several times, and that's really how we funded to date, which has been
good for you. Good for you. That's awesome. And as much as we point out some of the issues on the fundraising and financing side, and especially with the USDA, it's always good to hear of some success stories. So that's great to hear. My follow-up question there was. For those that are listening that aren't super intimate with the grant writing process, you're basically applying for money that's given to you, and it's not debt or equity, it's not an investment. You don't have to pay it back, but you have to kind of win it. You have to be awarded it. So, what have you focused on, kind of selling to the grant, the folks giving the grant money away, just like the economic opportunity in building the Yopon industry, or what's it been?
Yeah, I think that's been a lot of it. I mean, I think so. Grant writing, I guess so. My background is I have a CPA. I worked for Ernst & Young for a few years and then have my MBA in entrepreneurship. So I also know that from a farmer perspective, I probably have a little bit more of an ability to navigate the grant writing. And that's something that I've really seen. Like there are things where I'm like, I'm applying for the grant. And I'm like, how is any other farmer supposed to be able to do this? Like this is my background and I still am Googling words and like trying to figure out how to build a robust business model for them to follow. Like I completely agree. And I'm very grateful for the funding that we have had, but also know that I have a unique background to be able to even just like navigate it. And I still paid somebody the first time. Because it is very difficult to navigate. It's a lot of time, but you're right. Like it's non-dilutive. It's not free money, but in essence, and so I think with that, I would say there are more and more resources that are out there, of Like, I know the small business, sustainable business network has, is that something that they're working on in creating a regenerative agricultural and justice team? And that's one of the things that they're trying to work on is like, how do we get this USDA funding that has historically gone to bigger companies that may not be using it for good? How do we get that funding channeled to the people who are smaller and will be using this money for good instead of evil, right? And so I'd say reach out. I know the USDA is actually now putting a lot more money under this administration through the National Conservation Resource Services. So again, when I was at the Intertribal Agricultural Council in December, the USDA actually sent like 100 of their agents from the NCRS to, because they are going to be dispatching all of this capital and they want it to be as regenerative and climate smart as possible. And so talk to your NCRS agency. There's one in every county. And so they've got more projects that they're able to fund. And so I think don't necessarily try to do it on your own. It's really hard. What hard for me to figure out at first was that don't necessarily be writing like what your pitch would be, but rather like figure out how they grade. And then write to that. Which is a bit counterintuitive in some ways. Cause you're like, really, this is what I should be right. But at the same time, you know, they're following a rubric, right? And so write to that. And people know what that is. So find resources and they're out there. So
Well said. Well said. Congratulations again on that. That's beautiful.
Thanks.
I'm gonna take us home with the last question, which is the question that we ask everybody, which is how do we scale regen brands to have 50% market share by 2050?
By 2050. All right. So we got 27 years. I think it's
that like MCG accounting brain is going off right there. It's like, bam, 27.
I think you can't put your money where your mouth is, right? Like, if this is what we value, no one can work for free. No one can pay people for free. Like, if this is what you value, then buy this way, right? And also at the same time, understanding that, I don't expect anybody to pay 10x what the, maybe not as thoughtfully produced alternative would be. And so I think that's what it's hard, right? So like, how do we narrow the gap in that so that regenerative sourcing can be more affordable? And I think partly one of the things that CPG brands face is how do we make regenerative and sustainable choices available all the way through. Like, I feel like this is a choice I'm constantly making of, if I ship it in this packaging, there's a 50% chance it's going to break before it arrives, but at least they can compost it. Or if I ship it in this packaging, then only 50% of cities have the ability to recycle it. And so I think working together, and no brand can solve all of those problems, right? Like, so how do we get people all along the supply chain and all along, in each of those decisions, solving those problems, right? And so I think, and then also letting people be 50% of the way there, right? Like, I think sometimes it's easy to be accused of greenwashing or accused of, making bad choices when it's like, and you kind of sometimes along the way have to make better bad choices because it's not a clean industry and you're still literally, it's consumables, like by definition, consumer packaged goods. and so how do we like just keep moving that needle and like celebrate the like 5% improvements every few years? And then that will also help move the needle on the money piece, I think, too. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That reminds me of a phrase Anthony introduced me to a while back. And that's yes. Progress over perfection. He's probably laughing because he's probably about to say that. I'm trying to steal his thunder. But when you talk about the regenerative decisions that businesses have to make, I can't help but think, rewind back to a moment I had earlier in this podcast where I was like, just make an RTD, mm-hmm. make an RTD Yopon. But when you make an RTD, mm-hmm. a lot of packaging, you're shipping a ton of water. So there's a lot of, you know, shipping costs there, you know, broken glass and or the use of plastic versus what you've created with Vibe is significantly smaller. You can ship a huge quantity with a, you know, smaller carbon footprint. And to me, that strikes me as a very like regenerative, thoughtful decision because everybody mm-hmm. already has water. Do you need to ship the water or can you just ship the concentrate? So it's just for me, that was like a click as you were explaining that. I'm not sure if that's what your thought process was when you made that decision or not, but to me, it just totally makes sense.
And I think that, you know, you're exactly right. And, you know, maybe an RTD is still in the works, but having in my mind, I'm like, because that's how most tea is consumed in the US, right? So if we are going to build Yopon as an industry, I don't want to mix somebody coming along with an RTD, right? Like, because that's how you're going to get market capture. But it goes back to the like progress over perfection. And then if we already have the solution for the RTD on the other side with the Vibe crystals, it's like we already have the refill. If we have to do the RTD step to get the customer acquisition, then great, and eliminate it by 2030. But at the same time, you're exactly right. Like that was one of the reasons that we went with it is because like, how do we create a sustainable alternative to an RTD? So depending on which order that gets launched, like we'll see, but at the same time, that's exactly where we are.
It's really, really cool. Makes me think there's a whole like budding potential industry of like concentrates that could be out there. You know what I mean? It's a rabbit hole.
It's a good illustration to me though, too, of like, if you talk to anyone in just regular mainstream CPG, not even region, it all comes down to margin. Like it all comes down to margin to build profitability, to like build a sustainable business. And so on the regen side, like these systems all come down to margin as well, because on the big ag, big food, whatever, not all big is bad, but in the established entrenched food system, they figured out margin. They figured out margin for the chemical suppliers to the farms. They figured out the farm margins, even though we've abused them, they're not high as they should be. We figured out processor margins. We figured out distributor margins. We figured out retailer margins. Like they have this margin accordion figured out and it's humming and making music, right? Whereas we have a whole different context. We're making decisions off of on our side and we're trying to build the accordion and make, you know, figure out how big the margin needs to be and where the margin gets sacrificed and not. And that's really at the end of the day, like what's going to determine if we make this thing work.
Right.
And I think that's a perfect example of that as well. And RTD for those that are not in CPG, which stands for consumer packaged goods, means ready to drink, which is a beverage that is in a canister prepared and you just grab it off the shelf or the cooler and drink it right away.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, just to summarize, my two biggest takeaways from your answer to the, what do we have to do to get 50% market share by 2050 that I really liked were, put your money where your mouth is. Like if you really care about the planet, there are choices you can make. And yes, you might have to pay a little bit of a premium, but there are choices you can make that are better for the world and for your own health. And then part two of that was like, as an industry, we need to get better about making sure that those premiums aren't too high, because at some point it does become unreasonable, you know, for people to pay 3, 4, 5X for Yopon versus regular. You know,
I think regenerative or like agriculture should never be a luxury, right? And that's where it is right now. Yep. It's a luxury good, and that's one, unfair, and two, is never going to really move the needle.
Very well said. Very well said.
Couldn't agree more.
Abian, share the website URL, how else other people can support you. Wrap us up with just y'all's information so people can support and find y'all.
Great. Thanks. Catspringyopon.com. Or just Google.
Yopon, by the way, is spelled Y-A-U-P-O-N. Yes. Y-A-U-P-O-N.
Just that detail. Yeah, so find us on our website. We're available on Amazon. If you're in the Southwest region, which is Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, we're at Whole Foods and Central Markets, and we love working with other brands. So, yeah, that's where we are.
Love it. Thanks so much for joining us. It was great to have you.
Thank you. Awesome. Appreciate it.
For show notes and more information on our guests and what we discuss on the show, check out our website, regen-brands.com. That is regen-brands.com. You can also check out our YouTube channel, Regen Brands Podcast, for all of our episodes with both video and audio. The best way to support our work is to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe to future episodes. Thanks so much for tuning into the Regen Brands Podcast, brought to you by the Regen Coalition and Outlaw Ventures. We hope you learned something new in this episode, and it empowers you to use your voice, your time, and your dollars to help us build a better and more regenerative food system. Love you guys.